All right. That wasn't just a preview for, what's it called, Interstellar Rodeo, where that guy will be this summer. But we'll talk about that a little bit. Because today we're going to go on a bit of a journey. We're going to begin with sort of pessimism, and I hope we're going to end up at optimism, the kind of optimism that was represented by the first clip that I showed from a singer named Mavis Staples about the far celestial shore. So this clip that I just showed might represent the lowest point, so it's all uphill from here, hopefully. For those of you who don't know who that singer was, that was a performance of a song called Ballad of the Dying Man by a guy named Father John Misty, who again will be at Interstellar Rodeo this summer, he's sort of with his 70s grooves and his twisty, sly, darkly humorous lyrics that are dripping with this sort of level of irony that can only be matched by his hipster mustache that he's sporting these days. And his ability to sort of tread the extremely fine line between tasteful exuberance and shameless bombast, he sort of manages to make pessimism feel surprisingly good. This song is from his latest record, which is called Pure Comedy, which is this really masterful skewing of this sort of curious age that we find ourselves living in. This song in particular takes on this sort of infinitely ineffectual work of the social media crusader, those folks who think that they're just one perfectly worded tweet or post, comment, or blog entry from saving the world. And I mean, if you've spent more than 10 minutes on the internet in the last 20 years, you've undoubtedly encountered this sort of person. Chances are you've been this person. God knows I've been this person many times. It's an easy trap to fall into, right? You know, somebody, either a friend from high school, a former coworker, a relative you can't unfriend because of awkwardness at the next family reunion, some troll trying to get a rise out of people, perhaps the leader of some powerful country that I won't name, make some sort of egregious, racist, homophobic, bigoted, or just plain false statement, and we immediately feel the need to chime in with our thoughts. And of course, the undisputed logic and reasonableness of our discourse will ultimately be able to set the ill-informed poster straight once and for all, bringing the human race one step closer to unity of opinion and therefore world peace. Right? We've all had this thought. So such is the character that we're encountering in this song. Father John Misty, whose real name is Josh Tillman, situates his character on this sort of proverbial deathbed that's always useful to remember when we find ourselves becoming a little too obsessed with our petty annoyances, just for the sake of gaining a little insight. And the purpose of this context is to remind us that life is short, and that most of the time we spend fighting will seem like a waste of time when we're, you know, staring our own mortality in the face. Now, why this song is so brilliant in its irony is that Misty takes us to the deathbed, reveals the particular dying man, and then tells us that he's actually not that concerned. He is still concerned about all the petty things in his life that he just can't get over, right? There's no thought that he's somehow wasted his life. There's no memories of family or love or experience. Just a hope that these endless words that he sent out onto the internet to keep back the opinions of those who disagree with him will be remembered and useful and all those sorts of things. Those people he refers to as idiots, dilettantes, and fools who were, quote, on his watch, as though he were some sort of sentry guarding the castle of truth from the invaders at the gate. And the stanza ends with this line, "Lord, just a little more time, a plea to live longer." Not to do anything worthwhile, necessarily, just to spend more time on the internet. In the second verse, the dying man's thoughts turn to the world that will be left after he is dead. He fears that his perceived enemies will have free rein to spread their lies and wrongheaded opinions without him there to stop them. He worries about pretense and ignorance overwhelming the cultural discourse, as the, quote, homophobes, hipsters, and 1%, plus the false feminists, which is a particularly loaded term, I feel like, that he has personally managed to detect. What a great service to humanity that's been. And he fears that no one will be around to critique them, those people that he lists once he's died. And the bridge of the song contains this great line about the world made in his image, which I won't be able to fully unpack, despite its being really interesting, especially when we think in terms of these sort of digital echoes that we create around ourselves in the age of social media. But the third verse is my favorite. And I think the line where he says, eventually the dying man takes his final breath, but first checks his news feed to see what he's about to miss. I think that might be a contender for best couplet of the year. We'll see. The image is so well constructed that we can easily picture this sort of ancient man lying in a hospital bed connected to all sorts of machines that are keeping him alive, while his frail hand holds up a phone that he uses to thumb through the latest posts on his news feed, still getting indignant at what he sees. You know, it's pathetic and it's poignant all at the same time. And there's something really funny and tragic about this character's sort of intense, what I'm told kids are calling FOMO, the fear of missing out, right? Kids or my 30-year-old cousins. I also love the way that Misty manages to invoke both Ecclesiastes and Plato in just four quick lines, when he reminds of the sort of cyclical nature of life and the inability to really gain any insight. He says, we leave as clueless as we came, from the rented heavens to the shadows of the cave. Now, so for those of you who don't know your ancient Greek, for those of you who do know your ancient Greek philosophy, the reference to the cave is obvious. But just in case anyone's not up on their Plato, the gist of Plato's argument, he sort of had this metaphorical idea of the cave, and this idea that we're all living in this cave and we're sort of chained down, and what we actually see around us is just a shadow of what's going on behind us, projected against this wall in front of us. And that we have no hope of really living this sort of fulfilled life unless we can free ourselves from these restraints that keep us down and climb out of the cave to see the real world. That's sort of philosophy 101. But I'll come back to Plato in a minute. First, the verse, I just want to go back to this verse and the song, which end with this line that says, "We'll all be wrong someday." A sentiment that connects to what could be called the chorus of the song, which says, "In no time at all, this will be the distant past." I think the connections here to Ecclesiastes are pretty obvious. The idea that there's nothing new under the sun, and that all of our labor and intellectual pursuits are ultimately meaningless, since what we think is so true and relevant and important now will one day be proven wrong, seen as frivolous, and thought to be minor by some future society looking back on our time. Okay, I promise I'm not going to stay this pessimistic the whole time. We'll start getting happier soon. But first, we're going to go back to Plato, because I think that the cave is sort of a perfect analogy for this internet age that we live in, as it so aptly captures the obscuring effect that comes with the digital separation that we construct by means of the sort of social infrastructures designed ostensibly to bring us closer together. You see, the very act in engaging in social media immediately divides the expression from the expressor, whether that expression is a Facebook post, a tweet, a photo on Instagram, whatever it is you do on Snapchat. I don't know, I'm over 30. You know, all of that sort of stuff separates the person from what they're saying. And now I'm not saying that the whole social media enterprise is bad or wrong. I think it's a great way to keep in touch with people you don't see often. You know, there is pluses to it. But I think that it's important to sort of keep some perspective and not forget that we're participating in a form of communication that works best when the sort of breadth and complexity of the human being behind a particular statement is removed, so that the statement is removed from that statement for the purpose of efficiency. So when someone expresses an opinion, whether it's about politics or ice cream, the statement becomes an entity unto itself. The nuance and complexity of the person making the statement is not captured, and instead a simple binary is created. So if I criticize a politician who you happen to think is great, you know, I'm on the opposite side of the binary from you, and therefore, on that issue, I am wrong, and probably an idiot or a fool or a sucker for believing what I do. Whereas, if we were in a room together, and I made the same statement, your reaction might not be as visceral. My delivery of the statement might be tempered by having to actually look another person in the face. I might pull back based on your reaction. You might be able to tell from my body language the level of comfort I have with making such a statement. The intonation of my voice might also reveal how aggressively or flippantly I mean the statement to be. These non-textual forms of communication are deeply ingrained from us, obviously from millions of years of evolution that led to this complex and deeply nuanced system of language that we use every day. Social media tends to strip all of that away, leaving only words, an important but not independent part of language. Thus, like the denizens of Plato's cave, we of the internet age see but a shadow of the other human beings that represent this cacophony of commentary, and we call that shadow the whole picture because it's easier than imagining the reality behind the projection. The whole thing comes down to what is often referred to as the process of othering. This is the process of making a series of assumptions based on available information and projecting those assumptions onto someone else. And it's something that human beings do quite quickly and often subconsciously. We come by this trait honestly. Again, millions of years of evolution have made us extremely tribal. After all, our ancestors survived by banding together as groups in order to resist or overwhelm the strength of other groups. Hence, when we are confronted with difference, even something as innocuous as a difference of political opinion, our fight or flight instincts flare up and we feel the need to react in some way. Unlike our ancestors on an African plain somewhere, some time in the past, most of our lives here in the West are not threatened by the differences we encounter, but instincts run deep. Hence, our ability to dismiss someone with a different opinion out of fear that if that person can hold a particular opinion, they must have some innate flaw that is corrupting their entire being. So this fight or flight reaction to an encounter with the other is the basis for most of societal divides that we have to navigate. When we come down, we tend to group ourselves, right? There's liberalism versus conservatism, Muslims versus Jews, Jews versus Christians, Christians versus Muslims, Muslims versus other Muslims, Christians versus other Christians, Christians versus rock music, popular culture, the future of the earth, my favorite hockey, baseball, football, basketball, soccer, cricket, dodgeball team versus your favorite, the environment versus the economy, is tribalism, regionalism, nationalism, and its equally destructive cousin, patriotism. And the natural outgrowth of nationalism, which we call racism. And I say that because race, you know, as we're finding, psychologists are telling us, is just as much an unnatural construct as something like nationhood. Slight variations in bone structure, pigmentation, and hair are genetic traits and connote no essential intellectual or physical hierarchy. Those hierarchies are constructed and implemented by the power structures to which we adhere. So the last thing you need is another white man telling you about race. So I'm going to read from somebody else. This is a great book that came out last year. I bought this actually at Sam's Place, so you can find great books here. But it's by a guy named Tinashe Coates, who's a journalist, and he wrote this book sort of in the wake of a lot of the racial riots and things like that that have been going on in the States, Ferguson for one. And it's sort of framed as a letter to his son. So any of the I pronouns or we pronouns are not me speaking. I'm obviously not him. And so he sort of digs into this idea of race quite a bit in this book, but I'm just going to read the beginning of it to give a little bit of perspective into sort of how this is perceived by the people who are most hurt by racism. And of course, he's an American writer, but I think in Canada we have our own race problems that this can easily be applied to. I'm just going to read about a page here. This leads us to an equally important ideal, one that Americans implicitly accept but to which they make no conscious claim. Americans believe in the reality of race as a defined, indubitable feature of the natural world. Racism, the need to ascribe bone-deep features to people and then humiliate, reduce, and destroy them, inevitably follows from this inalterable condition. In this way, racism is rendered as the innocent daughter of Mother Nature, and one is left to deplore the middle passage or the trail of tears the way one deplores an earthquake, a tornado, or any other phenomenon that can be cast as beyond the handiwork of men. But race is the child of racism, not the father. And the process of naming the people has never been a matter of genealogy or physiognomy so much as one of hierarchy. Difference in hue and hair is old, but the belief that the preeminence of hue and hair, the notion that these factors can correctly organize a society, and that they signify deeper attributes which are indelible. This is a new idea at the heart of these new people who have been brought up hopelessly, tragically, deceitfully to believe that they are white. These new people are, like us, a modern invention. But unlike us, their new name has no real meaning divorced from the machinery of criminal power. The new people were something else before they were white: Catholic, Corsican, Welsh, Mennonite, Jewish. And if all of our national hopes have any fulfillment, then they will have to become something else again. Perhaps they will truly become American and create a nobler basis for their myths. Now, there's a lot going on in there. We could spend a while unpacking everything that he says, but I'm going to try and stay focused. The main point I want to take away is the destructive results that flow from emphasizing the type of person over the actual person. To think in spiritual terms, the body over the soul. Once we see the world through a lens of race, we're able to either blame or justify the actions of an individual based on the racial category we view them as belonging to. Conversely, we can justify our own actions or feelings towards individuals based on how we group them. This is how we end up in a world where some schools, neighborhoods, cities, and entire countries feel justified in blocking whole people groups from entering. Despite claims that we want to accept the, quote, good ones, fear of the other gets renamed common sense, a blanket term often co-opted by politicians and other leaders to silence arguments that require the sort of cognitive dissonance that doesn't win you elections. Now, I promised I was going to lift us out of this pessimism, so I'm going to start and try and do that now. I want to read something from C.S. Lewis. It's a bit from his book called The Great Divorce, which I did not buy here because I didn't have a copy. I had to get this from the library. If you haven't read The Great Divorce, it is a really interesting book, and I recommend it. It's an imagining of the afterlife that borrows from such other imaginings as Dante's Divine Comedy. It also takes a few ideas from Plato's Cave. Now, the excerpt I'm going to read comes from early in the book. The narrator has arrived in a gray town, which we later discover is a version of purgatory or hell. And he boards this bus that he is told is going to take him to heaven. And while he's on the bus, he has a conversation about the nature of this sort of town that he's just arrived in and some of its more famous inhabitants. So this is a little bit longer of a quote, but interesting, I think. Okay, here we go. It seems the deuce of a town, I think that means double of a town in this sort of 1950s British writing. And that's what I don't seem to understand. The parts of it I saw were so empty. Was there once one much larger population? Not at all, said my neighbor. The trouble is that they're so quarrelsome. As soon as anyone arrives, he settles in some street. But before he's been there 24 hours, he quarrels with his neighbor. Before the week is over, he quarrels so badly that he decides to move. Very likely he finds the next street empty because all the people there have quarreled with their neighbors and moved. If so, he settles in. If by any chance the street is full, he goes further. But even if he stays, it makes no odds. He's sure to have another quarrel pretty soon, and he'll move on again. Finally, he'll move right out to the edge of town and build a new house. You see, it's easy here. You only have to think of a house and there it is. That's how the town keeps on growing, leaving more and more empty streets. That's right. And it's sort of odd here. That place where we caught the bus is thousands of miles from the Civic Center, where all the newcomers come from Earth. All the people you've met were living near the bus stop, but they had taken centuries of our time to get there by gradual removals. And what about the earlier arrivals? I mean, there must be people who came from Earth to your town even longer ago. That's right, there are. They've been moving on and on, getting further apart. They're so far apart now that they could never think of coming to the bus stop at all. Astronomical distances. There's a bit of rising ground near where I live, and a chap has a telescope. You can see the lights of the inhabited houses where those old ones live, millions of miles away. Millions of miles from us and from one another. Every now and then, they move further still. That's one of the disappointments. I thought you'd meet interesting historical characters, but you don't. They're too far away. Would they get to the bus stop in time if they ever set out? Well, theoretically, but it'd be a distance of light years. And they wouldn't even want to by now. Not those old chaps like Tamburlaine and Genghis Khan, or Julius Caesar or Henry V. Wouldn't want to? That's right. The nearest one of those old ones is Napoleon. We know that because two chaps made the journey to see him. They'd started long before I came, of course, but I was here when they came back. About 15,000 years of our time it took them. We picked out the house by now, just a little pinprick of light and nothing else near it for millions of miles. But they got there? That's right. He built himself a huge house in the Empire style, rows of windows flaming with light, though it only shows as a pinprick from where I live. Did they see Napoleon? They went right up and looked through the windows, through one of the windows. Napoleon was there, all right. What was he doing? Walking up and down, all the time, left, right, never stopping for a moment. The two chaps watched him for about a year, and he never rested, and muttered to himself all the time, it was Salt's fault, it was Ney's fault, it was Josephine's fault, it was the fault of the Russians, it was the fault of the English. Like that, all the time. Never stopped for a moment. A little fat man, and he looked kind of tired, but he didn't seem to be able to stop it. So this other author, thinker named Jean-Paul Sartre famously said that hell is other people. Lewis here seems to take that one step further by pointing out that hell is both other people and isolation. What an interesting conundrum that is to sort out. The thing I've always loved about this imagining of the afterlife is the fluidity of it. There is no black and white dichotomy, but a space wherein the agency of individuals decides their experiences. So I'm not going to make any claims about the actual afterlife. I don't know what's coming, and frankly, neither does anybody else. But what is interesting here is the way that this image of the afterlife works as a metaphor for the mechanisms of grace that we experience. Napoleon isn't going off alone, light years from everyone else, because of what he did on Earth. He's there because even in the afterlife, he's chosen to reject grace, community, and forgiveness. He would rather isolate himself and dwell on the actions of his enemies. He is in hell, but it's a hell that he created by refusing to participate in the community that's offered to him. And instead of creating a community that's made up of voices, he's created a community that's made up of the voices that he crafts within his mind from the memories of the people that he knew. Does that sound familiar? I think to me, it feels very similar to the way in which our digital personalities interact. One person posts an article I think is offensive, another makes a comment I find ridiculous, a third person can't stop posting about a TV show that I think looks moronic, and I begin to take these statements as indicative of the person as a whole rather than understanding that this is but one aspect of a robust human being with fears, joys, hopes, dreams, varying opinions, good days, bad days, frustrations, bouts of depression, all of the complex things that make us human beings. None of us would want to be judged by the content of our social media, I don't think. And yet, I'm sure we've all been guilty of judging others under those terms. I know I have. Now, of course, social media is the obvious example, but I think this sort of distancing takes place in all sorts of interactions, whether it's not wanting to visit our parents, avoiding a neighbor, not taking a call from a friend, staying away from a certain neighborhood out of fear of encountering those types of people. labeling common activities as an inconvenience because it cuts into our leisure time, willfully creating an echo chamber by pushing those who disagree with us out of our lives. All of these are strategies we participate in to create our own little hells of isolation, like Napoleon did in Lewis's book. By resisting connections with those we think will not disagree with us, we lose out on this unique pleasure of community, which, despite being difficult and at times uncomfortable, fulfills a deeply seated desire within every human soul to know and to be known, to care and to be cared for, to love and to be loved. I know that's not an easy prospect for some people, myself included, but I think that that's what Jesus was onto when he said, "Wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am with them." And I remember being told when I was growing up that this verse was some sort of formula for how you get God to show up, which always left me wondering if God were actually there when I was alone. It's one of the many problems with taking things literally rather than poetically. But I don't think that Jesus had anything close to a church service or a ritual in mind when he said those words. Rather, I feel that he was encouraging us to share our lives with each other, to be present to each other, to be open to the grace that flows through Christ when we minister, in the least religious sense of that term, to each other and in community. So, to finish up, it's going to be an early Sunday. Again, we have no music today, so I want to show something. This is the final 10 minutes from this Terrence Malick film, The Tree of Life, which maybe some of you saw, maybe some of you heard about a few years ago. And I think this will sort of bring us full circle back to that far celestial shore that Mavis Staples was singing about at the beginning. Now, the film is very enigmatic and sort of expressionistic in its imagery, so I can't give you a simple explanation for what you're going to see. The rest of the film is about this family attempting to come to terms with the loss of one of their sons, either to war or suicide. It's not really clear. And so the family is, you'll see Brad Pitt, Jessica Chastain. Those are the parents of this family. Sean Penn is in here too. He's sort of grown up. The time is all kind of all over the place. Don't worry about it if you don't get it. People have been wrestling over this movie for a long time. But sort of the way I interpret it, this final bit of the movie can be read as an image of the afterlife, as a vision of the afterlife, or it can be read more as somewhat abstract, impressionistic beauty, vision of the beauty, confusion, wonder, and complicated nature of this mysterious thing we call grace. So we're going to watch that. We're going to pass around the communion. This is kind of our worship time. Just try and engage with it in whatever way you see.